It's hard to find the time to read all of the best articles on Bitcoin and the crypto economy. So let me read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. Welcome back to the Crypto Economy, everybody. We are jumping right into part two today of Bitcoin Astronomy, from the Unchained Capital blog, and written by Dhruv Bansal. And we are starting into the section titled The Art of Hash War. If you haven't listened to yesterday's episode, we are literally jumping right into the middle of this, so it's not going to make any sense. Make sure you go back and listen to part one. On the Law of Hash Horizons, the Musk Coin Revolution, and the Currency War Between the Martians and the Terran Bitcoin Empire. But for all those who did listen to yesterday's episode, let's jump into The Art of Hash War. The art of war teaches us to rely not on the likelihood of the enemy's not coming, but on our own readiness to receive him, not on the chance of his not attacking, but rather on the fact that we have made our position unassailable. Sun Tzu. Martian revolutionaries have two significant advantages that they will seek to maximize before they engage in hash war. The first law of Bitcoin astronomy cuts both ways. As Earth's hash horizon prevented Martian miners from mining Bitcoin, Mars' own hash horizon is a bulwark against attacks from Terran miners. In the future, the Bitcoin mining industry is extremely efficient. Most Terran miners will prefer to mine Bitcoin and earn settlement fees in Bitcoin rather than use their hash rate to attack Musk coin. Only some fraction of Terran miners will feel sufficiently antagonistic towards Musk coin to spend hash rate attacking it. This suggests that the timing of the Musk coin launch is extremely important. Launched too early, in small pools of antagonistic Terran miners will be able to hash bomb Musk coin just for the lulz. Long before actually launching Musk coin, smart Martian revolutionaries will perform simulations to determine whether or not they have sufficient relative hash rate against their Terran adversaries to support a Musk coin launch. They will produce analyses like the one below, produced with the Hash Wars program. The plot shows the defensibility of a new blockchain given various distances between the blockchain's defenders and attackers, as well as their relative hash rate. At zero distance, the white line, and with 50% relative hash rate, the defenders should win exactly 50% of the blocks by weight. This is the dead center of the plot. Following the white zero distance line to the left, as the relative hash rate of defenders decreases, they mine fewer blocks. Following this white line to the right, as their relative hash rate increases, they mine more blocks. At zero distance, the relationship between hash rate and block weight mined is linear, as expected. But now look at the red-orange curve for Mars's distance. At 50% relative hash rate, this curve predicts Martians should mine slightly more than 50% of all blocks. This makes sense because this simulation assumes the blockchain starts at the location of the defender, giving them a small initial advantage. Even though attacker-defender hash rate is evenly split, the Martian's hash horizon maintains this initial advantage. Following the red-orange curve for Mars' distance to the left, when Martian defenders have less relative hash rate than attackers, the curve drops faster than the white zero-distance line. This is a direct consequence of the law of hash horizons. Being in the minority at a distance confers a mining disadvantage. Conversely, following the red-orange Mars curve to the right, it rises faster than the white zero-distance line. This is the law of hash horizons again, but this time the disadvantage is the attackers, because they have the smaller hash rate. This effect is even more dramatic for the outer planets at greater distances. The further a new blockchain launches from its potential attackers, the less relative hash rate is needed to defend it. Martians will perform more realistic simulations than those presented here. They will try to plot their own hash rate curve, predicting their chances for success given their hash rate estimates. But are there any other techniques which can adjust the odds in their favor? Advanced blockchain defense strategies. There are also other techniques Martians can use to boost their resistance against Terran hash rate that require Musk Coin to make some changes to Bitcoin's consensus rules. Musk Coin could adopt a different hashing algorithm than Bitcoin. Whether this would provide much defense against Terran adversaries depends upon how easily hash rate can be reconfigured or produced in the future. Computing technology could potentially be faster and more flexible in the future, making specificity or performance trade-offs such as those made by current generation ASICs less relevant. There may be less design space to, quote, get ahead of the current generation of Bitcoin miners. It's also possible that manufacturing in the future is extremely fast and automated, and that once an ASIC design is known, it's easy to mass produce in 3D printing industrial fabricators. Musk Coin could merge mine with Bitcoin. Inserting Bitcoin block headers into Musk Coin blocks and having Musk Coin clients also be Bitcoin clients. The weight of a Musk Coin block could be defined as including the weight of the Bitcoin blocks behind it. This lets Musk Coin piggyback from Bitcoin's existing hash rate and security at the cost of being integrated with it. Perhaps in combination with the above strategy, Musk Coin could prohibit long reorgs, dramatically increasing resistance to distant hash rate. If a robust, trustless proof of location algorithm can be created, it's possible that new blockchains seeking to resist distance hash rate might demand proof of proximity to a certain location, the core of Mars, before accepting candidate blocks from miners. In our early era, it's hard to know what the impacts of the proposals above would be on the consensus behavior and viability of Musk Coin. But in the future, blockchain engineering will be much better understood, a science rather than a dark art. Martians may have other consensus-based defenses which we cannot fathom today. Win Phobos. When the time is right, Martians will have the tools and strategies to help them launch and defend Musk Coin. But when will this be? How long exactly before Musk Coin goes to the moons? The answer to that question may be also the answer to another. Why is Bitcoin's issuance schedule so long and drawn out? It makes sense that most Bitcoin are minted in the first 20 years of Bitcoin's history. Early adopters need to be incentivized to evangelize and build on the network. But why continue to trickle out tiny amounts of Bitcoin per block for another 120 years? Why not 60 or 240? What if Satoshi was trying to estimate something? Martian Satoshi conjecture. What if Satoshi designed Bitcoin's block reward schedule to continue minting Bitcoin until the year 2140, when sufficient hash rate is developed on Mars to launch a new blockchain? Even if this conjecture is false, at some date in the future, the Musk Coin revolution will succeed. Bitcoin will continue to dominate trade near Earth, but Musk Coin will be used near Mars. Trade between the worlds will rely on cross-chain atomic swaps. The BTC Musk Coin price, once volatile, will settle to reflect humanity's collective views on the future of the two civilizations, much as fiat currencies do today, but without the ability to manipulate supply. Bitcoin beyond Mars. Near Sol. The cynicism of Terran no-coiners during the Musk Coin revolution will be understood as a reasonable stance to have taken, given the total hegemony of Bitcoin in their lives. After the revolution, everyone will understand that successful human colonies near locations with abundant natural resources that are able to attract settlers and build industry will launch their own blockchains once they have sufficient political will and hash rate. Indeed, becoming a peer in the SolChain network will become the definition of what it means to be a successful colony. Future econobiologists will see the Musk coin revolution as not exceptional, but natural. An expanding civilization limited by light lag must necessarily become more distributed. A blockchain makes a strong body for an economy, but it is anchored to its center of hash. When a spore of humanity lands in a far-off place, it relies on tenuous connections back to its parent blockchain body. If the location is rich in resources, the spore multiplies and becomes capable of extracting more energy from its environment. Eventually, a new blockchain body springs forth, reliant on its own mining metabolism, carrying the genetic imprint of the original chain, but now independent. A child body, a daughter chain. In this way, blockchains will seep across the solar system, attracted by energy and resources. Flocks of mobile transport miners will migrate among the worlds, looking for the best way to arbitrage fuel and time across interplanetary hash rate and shipping markets. Humanity will grow like a fungus or slime mold, comfortable in our warm and dark corner of the Milky Way. Note, this section was inspired by conversations with and the excellent work of Brandon Quittam. Beyond Sol, an embarrassment of riches. What will it take to extend the tendrils of our civilization across the gaps between the stars? Science fiction often presents interstellar colonization as an inevitability of future progress. The more realistic scenario is that humanity will reach some point where interstellar colonization becomes theoretically possible, but practically unachievable due to costs. While it may be practical to send small probes quickly, sending thousands of humans and equipment on a years-long journey to another star will be one of the biggest investments humanity ever makes. What would be the return? Consider that there is sufficient matter and energy right here in the solar system to support indefinite growth in human population. Feedstocks of metals, water, and gases are all abundant in asteroids, comets, moons, and the gas and ice giants. We know how to create spin gravity, and the asteroid belt alone has enough raw material to fashion many thousands of Earths worth of living space in artificial habitats. Fusion powered by water could let us ignite miniature suns for ourselves wherever we choose to live. And we can begin to harvest the enormous power output by the sun each second, currently lost to space, uncollected by anyone. Why would there be demand to settle a new star if our own solar system has infinite supply? Distance makes the hash grow stronger. Why settle Alpha Centauri? Because it's far away. The answer again lies in blockchains, distance, and artificial scarcity. While the first Martian settlers were easily able to use Bitcoin on Earth, the first settlers of Alpha Centauri would be operating with a 4-year light lag to Earth. This would make Bitcoin and any other Sol chain unusable by Centaurians far before they even arrived at their destination, while they were still in deep space. Once they arrived at their destination, this light lag would give them a tremendous advantage defending against antagonistic hash rate on Earth. They would be able to start their own blockchain far sooner after their founding than any Sol chain in history. In this way, the first settlers of Alpha Centauri would be given two unique opportunities. First, they get to make history by being the first humans to settle another star system. Second, they make fortunes by quickly being able to start and mine their own blockchain. As the Sol system grows more crowded, the perceived return on the investment of a colonization mission will grow. The time frame for this investment may be a century or more, but the hyper-Bitcoinized future is one of sound money, low time preference, and correspondingly long investment horizons. Mallory was asked, "Why climb Mount Everest?" And his stoic response has become famous, the slogan of explorers and adventurers ever since. Because it's there. Some future Mallory, head of the first Alpha Centauri settlement mission, will be asked, "Why settle Alpha Centauri?" And their response will similarly become famous, an inspiration to countless new colonists, because it's far away. Blockchains incentivize our species to spread far apart so that great distances may intervene, casting their hash horizons over colonial outposts like dark wings, protecting new, fledgling coins. If this hypothesis is true, it means that Bitcoin is more than merely new money. It is a new driver in the expansion of civilization and will play a bigger role in the future story of humanity than any of us now realize. Hodl on. Beyond Humanity. Stay tuned for part two of this series, in which we examine the more universal consequences of those speculations, and part three, in which we dig into how blockchains will transform our understanding of space and time. All right, let's hit our sponsor real quick and we'll jump back in. Even aside from the whole hash war thing, just the concept of a blockchain, of a unique coin as a mechanism or essentially a gold rush for interstellar travel is one of the most interesting ideas ever. And it's another element to that that reproduction element, to the whole proof of life concept that Dergigi and Brandon Quidham, which I love that whole section just inspired by Brandon Quidham, is great. That the very nature of it being far away is what makes the dynamics of the system just an extraordinary investment that you can basically get in on the ground floor. Rather than being tied to the money of a different civilization, you're isolating that civilization in such a way, like in a monetary way, so that it is its own investment. So that when you're getting in on the ground floor, you're getting in on the currency that will be the currency of an entirely new civilization. And just by sheer light lag, we can't reach consensus on those. And that's an element that's specific to blockchains. It's just a fascinating idea. And it really leads to it truly reinforces the concept of the elements of life and the elements of self-organization that these higher order systems actually have, that it is more organizing us than we are organizing it. I mean, that's a pretty crazy idea to try to wrap your head around, that this is providing incentives for us to work for it. The whole 21 lessons of Bitcoin, or of the Bitcoin rabbit hole idea, that we will change more than Bitcoin will change us more than we will change it. Another really fascinating element to this is that the speed of light is actually a limit to the salability of money. Because that's essentially what we're talking about with money in this form, is that, and it may be a situation where Bitcoin is still accepted on all of these, like, external colonies in some form or fashion, but only in some abstract sense of, you know, hedging to the Terran economy, because it still won't make any grand sense to make, it doesn't make any sense to make use of that on your actual, on a colony that can't actually mine and protect. I think he's right, actually, whether it would be a revolutionary style break or something. The law of hash horizons is accurate as long as the speed of light remains a limit for our ability to communicate. There is no way to achieve meaningful consensus across such a great barrier of space and time. Now, one thing that Dhruv says in the beginning, in the first part of this, that I think actually could be challenged a little bit is that the Musk coin revolution wouldn't have any effect on Bitcoin. I would say that that would actually be more dependent on when Musk coin, when this new coin was created in the life cycle of the Martian colony. So if it occurs right at the beginning of its founding, when, you know, there's hardly anybody there and it's just like this, you know, bubble colony or something, well, then yeah, it wouldn't have any effect, but it would be because of the economic productivity on Mars is incredibly low. The colony is very small. The number of people is very small, etc. It would be like a tiny village or maybe a large neighborhood deciding to not use Bitcoin. It's not going to move. Even now, it wouldn't really move the price of Bitcoin very much. They also need the hash rate advantage in order to ensure the defense of their own blockchain. So it would seem less likely that that could even happen, that it could happen that early, but more that it would happen when the economy and civilization or the colony, whatever, was to a size of a really large city-state or even that of a nation. So that economy, demonetizing Bitcoin in its locality, would have an effect on Bitcoin. If we were in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, the value of Bitcoin would steadily rise in purchasing power, though it wouldn't rise in any, in the price of some other currency, because we're talking about, like, Bitcoin is the currency, so, you know, one Bitcoin would be one Bitcoin, as they say. So the effect wouldn't be great, it wouldn't be massive, but it could certainly lead to a more severe midterm, like mid-range bear market in basically a recession and corresponding increase in Bitcoin-denominated prices of goods in the short to mid-term if the Martian economy is substantial enough to have an effect in essentially separating in that split of the two organisms, the two chains. And that effect is worsened if you have a situation where, like, Earth is actually has a high export essentially to Mars, because Mars is going to be in desperate need of additional machinery and stuff that probably only has the infrastructure or the specific, you know, resources or materials to make on Earth and then send to Mars, whereas Mars has, you know, its own resources and differing materials and stuff. So if Earth has a high export, then that would actually exacerbate that problem, because the value of Musk, you're essentially putting all of this capital behind the Musk coin currency, as opposed to, and you know, essentially sending it away from the Bitcoin currency. So, like, the backing of any currency is essentially the market or the economy that is accepting it. So every time we add another person says, I accept Bitcoin, like, I value Bitcoin, their productivity, their capital, anything that they want to exchange for Bitcoin, that's what's backing Bitcoin. The market backs Bitcoin. So in the situation where we're sending all of our capital and resources to Mars because it's a really good investment, well, then we're essentially backing Musk coin with additional capital at the expense of Bitcoin. And this could get exaggerated, too. So, like, Muskcoin could actually start a bit of a speculative attack on Bitcoin in that sense, since they do have that division between them. So if Muskcoin is able to actually thrive and defend its own chain and its own center of hash, well, then there would inevitably be Terrans who invested in Muskcoin simply because, calling them Terrans cracks me up, simply because of the profit potential of investing in the base layer of the Martian economy, which is what you would be doing. You would be investing in a coin or a currency that would then be the pricing mechanism. It would be the good that soaked up all the productive value of the Martian economy. So the dynamics of a currency war in that era is just really, really fascinating. He's got the law of hash horizons, like, plot. There's actually some really good, I stopped and really looked at the graphics that he has in here, and you can actually get a lot out of these graphics. I love how much, there's actually a lot of work put into what seems like a really kind of silly idea, but it's fascinating and rather true. Like these are real implications that would occur in the case of a Martian versus Earth attempt at creating a blockchain-based money in competing with Bitcoin, essentially. And there's the Earth Hash Horizon a graphic that he has about how far away in light seconds you how much hash power you would need in order to actually be mining viable based on the light seconds, the distance that you are from Earth. And even in the cases where you're underneath the hash horizon, or excuse me, I guess you would be over top of the hash horizon where you actually could mine profitably, you're still going to run into many more orphans. Like just the nature of the mining out at that distance, it's like mining with, you know, 1 minute lag. How much hash power do you have to account for the fact that, you know, you're like one out of every 10, right? You got 1 minute out of every 10 that you're losing. Therefore, you're 1 in 10, essentially something like 10% more likely to have an orphan, even based on a higher hash rate. So you need to be producing enough blocks to make up that difference. But no matter what, your best chance of being more profitable in mining is moving closer to the center of hash, unless you actually have enough hash power to pull the center of hash toward you. So that plot actually tells a really cool story. That one, as well as he's got this, where is that? Oh man. The Defender hash rate, the hash horizon advantage and disadvantage, is such a fascinating idea. So, and I'd really kind of like to see, hopefully he digs deeper into the law, because it makes both defense of a chain with 51% hash power and the consequences of only 49% of the hash power worse. So defense of the chain is easier, but then having more than 50% of the chain hash rate gives you more than just, you know, that 1% or 2% advantage, because you also have the time difference. And then having less gives you the disadvantage, the typical disadvantage, plus the time difference. So the time difference can either work in your favor or against your favor. And there's this middle ground where it wants to, that center of hash will swing quickly from one center of the hash power to the other, as far as like distance goes. Like its balancing will never land right in the middle, because the pull at that point to one side or the other is the greatest. So the problem is progressive. As you get further from 50% on either way, the problem is either much worse or the benefit is much greater. And so think about that in terms of, like, if Earth had enough hash power to attack Muscoin, and technically it doesn't even have to happen maliciously, even though I get to that in just a second, but the center of hash, imagine it sent the center of hash actually just shifted back toward Earth. So like the vast amounts of capital, like the thousands of years of infrastructure and the lower costs of organization and computing power inevitably on Earth, while the Musk coin colony or whatever is still getting off the ground, could lead to sort of a extremely powerful gravity for the center of hash to be pulled toward Earth, even if Musk coin starts on Mars. And again, this could not, it doesn't necessarily have to be a malicious attack. It could almost be accidental, because of course there would have to be, you know, a few requirements for that to make any sense. Like on Earth, it would not be possible to mine at the beginning unless you turned on enough hardware, unless you turned on enough hash power immediately to steal the center of hash toward Earth. So, in which it then wouldn't be possible to mine on Mars again until you get closer to that 50% range. So in the meantime, so if you're mining at 30 or 40% on Mars because Earth just doubled your hash rate and stole the center of hash, you have to, at 30% or so, you're not making any money. You're not getting any of the blocks. So it's just a cost. It's just a huge sunk cost. You have to get back to 40, 50, 60% to try to steal that center of hash back. But that's when it doesn't really make sense for the Terrans to steal the center of hash, because that would actually be just as bad. That would be as bad for them in the context of the currency existing in their center of hash, because now it's competing with Bitcoin. So now we're in a situation where you have two currencies in the same market. They're existing in the same space-time location and now have to compete for each other in a winner-take-all market. So it only exists, I mean, it only makes sense for Muscoin to exist in a different hash horizon. So, like, and then the idea of a hash bomb thrown into that mix is just fascinating. I never thought about it. Like, I love this article just for these, like, little neat little things that come up. I mean, think about if we're totally talking about the possibility of truly competing and possibly very tribal civilizations here. And Martians refer to themselves as Martians. You know, we've got multiple generations. They can't even come to Earth because the gravity would destroy their bodies. They haven't been built. They haven't grown up in the environment that would make that even possible. Like, there would be heavy divisions between those two civilizations, inevitably. But you could straight up create a hash bomb. Granted, this would be an incredibly expensive bomb. While that's kind of the dynamics of violence in the physical realm, that it's a whole hell of a lot cheaper to destroy than it is to create. Like it's a whole lot easier to, you know, get a stick of dynamite that will blow up a house than it takes a whole lot less energy and effort to blow the house up with a stick of dynamite than it does to build the house. So, and of course, to make the house defensible against a brick of dynamite. So, in that sense, the dynamics of hash actually are one-to-one. It's like the dynamics of the dynamite and the house are the same. The amount of effort that you put into the house is how much dynamite you're able to protect yourself from in the same amount of effort. Like, if somebody wants to blow up your house, you would have to do all of the same amount of work it takes to make all the nails and the wood and put it all together and everything, because that's the only way to create the good, or whatever it is in this case, dynamite, to actually undo the defense. That's what was something that's really interesting about a hash as a technology, is the same energy to defeat it is the energy to create it. It's a one-to-one dynamic rather than like a million-to-one, where I can get a stick of dynamite for dirt cheap and blow up an very, very expensive house, at least comparatively. So that's why a hash bomb would be an incredibly expensive bomb, where a stick of dynamite or something is not an expensive bomb for what you're getting out of, for the amount of damage that you're actually doing. But it would basically be a sort of economic virus, because what you'd be doing is you'd include more blocks than the entirety of the Musk coin chain from its very genesis. So, for those of you who don't really know the ins and outs of this, quick summary, like, Bitcoin only achieves consensus because we build on all the previous chains, all the previous blocks, and the only thing that separates it is the fact that it's the current chain that is consensus is the one with the most hash, the valid one that's got the most hashes behind it, essentially. So someone could, theoretically, if they had a computer that was billions of times faster than any other computer that we actually have on the market, than ASIC chips and everything, could in secret hash an entirely new Bitcoin blockchain from the very beginning, back in 2009, and produce an entirely separate one where they own every single block, every single coin in history, because all the coins came from mining a block, everybody's history would be deleted. No one would own any coins, and they would broadcast it, and every single client would see it as the valid chain with the most hash power, or really the most proof of work. So that's incredibly unlikely because simply because the market distributes technology very quickly, and because it's a global, because everything on Earth exists within the same time horizon and the same hash horizon, we can mine from any jurisdiction in the world. There are no separations between mining in China and mining in the U.S., but the lag between them is so tiny as to be unrecognizable. And so that leads to, so if we're talking about like a hash bomb, like if we sent like a hash bomb to Muscoin, where we literally remined the entire chain and then broadcast it to the other planet, it's this blob of information. It could take 20 minutes to get there, and it's just traveling through space that would just create complete and total economic devastation when it got downloaded, when it was finally downloaded on the other side. It would truly be like deleting the entire financial history of our country. Like, imagine you just had a shutoff button for all of the financial data in the entire world. It all just vanished. Every bank account, the owner of every stock, every card balance, the what you got in your cash app, your paycheck, everything, every form of digital money ledger. Just poof, just disappeared. That would be an absolute, like, just, it would flatten the economy almost as well as a freaking nuclear bomb would. In fact, it would be more painful than a nuclear bomb, because if you just wiped out the whole planet, at least nobody would suffer in this situation. It would be years to actually recover from. So that's just such a fascinating idea of a hash bomb. I never thought about it, but I loved when my brain was going a mile a minute as soon as he started talking about it. I was like, oh my God, that's so genius. But what's funny is that this concept actually makes Satoshi's words for the Bitcoin system more insightful, like more applicable to these ideas. So some of you may not know this, but the term blockchain isn't actually in the white paper. Blockchain actually came, well, there's a number of different like cases where people have said blockchains, and it actually dates back like 20 or so years before Bitcoin as a chain of like signatures. But it's never been used in the term that we think of it now, blockchains. It wasn't until a couple of years after Bitcoin. And I think one of the only people that said early on blockchains as like a blockchain or the blockchain, I think, even though it was two words, was Hal Finney. But it was not, again, that term was not there. In fact, the closest Satoshi, I believe, ever came to using that term was a chain of blocks, like quote unquote. So the white paper and Satoshi originally referred to Bitcoin as a time chain. And just that word, time chain, paints a really different picture when you look at the hash horizon concept. It's because there is too much time distance between those separate time chains that consensus becomes impossible. So you immediately realize that the division between these things, the further you get from the center of the hash, the greater the divide. So the barriers between time chains are only determined by time differences of the two chains in relation to their space. So you look back at this thing as if it's an organism. Like I love the whole hat tip to Brandon Quittam section of this article. But if Bitcoin is an organism, if it's a codified organism, analogous to a human or, more obviously, a fungus or something, what separates one organism from another? So we all have the same instructions, right? Even us and fungi, like we share the majority of our DNA with fungi. So why are we separate beings? Why are we separate organisms? Well, there are certain chemical and protein barriers, specific aspects of our instructions of that DNA that make us incompatible because we are both protein-based beings. So a time chain in this analogy is an organism that's reliant on the compatibility requiring all participating machines to exist in a similar field of time. And so their realities, their states of being, can be shared rather than conflict with each other. So Satoshi, despite not realizing it, which Dhruv says in this piece, sets the initial parameters of Bitcoin that would define the hash horizon for opposing time chains to actually exist, like the distance from Earth that they would need to be to actually not get sucked into the gravity well of the winner-takes-all monetary economics of competing with Bitcoin, essentially. So the barriers between them are set by time distance in relation to the consensus gap. So Bitcoin being 10 minutes, if Muscoin is an hour, well, then their time horizon increases. So again, it's based on, just like us, it's based on the DNA. How closely compatible are certain sets of instructions in our DNA? And this one is based on the consensus gap between the average distance in time between our previous block and the next block. So another of the plots that he has in this article, which is really awesome, it shows the center, a mock-up of a dashboard from, I think it's like from 2038 or something, about the center of hash. Where is this thing? Yeah. It shows the center of hash between miners on, I'm not sure if this is supposed to be on different planets or something. It's got exahashes per second, Paropsis, rocket supplies, moving parts, experts group. There's so much fun. You really got to look at this stuff. Go to this article on Unchained.Capital and look at the graphics and just look at them and see if you can tell what story they're trying to explain, because it's just hilarious to me. But so this plot, it's showing the separation between the center of hash, or showing the average center of hash. The average center of hash, the center of hash between a bunch of different like high hash rate locations. And I guess these for distance, 216 kilometers, 247 kilometers. What would this be? That's not actually Earth, unless those distances are like in like thousands of kilometers, maybe. Center of hash distance. I don't know. I can't tell if this is like a planet or if this is supposed to be like a solar system, whatever it is. But it kind of makes it, it kind of shows you, like if you tried to imagine zooming way out from this, that we've got this ring of the time horizon, of the hash horizon, for how far away a new center of hash has to be so that it doesn't collapse into the old one. So it has to be further apart in light time than the time of the average consensus window. So a center of hash that lands anywhere in between is simply going to, you know, gradually, then suddenly, hat tip to Parker Lewis, collapse back into, or plummet toward one of the other center of hashes. So if you've got like a center of hash between, Mars and Earth, then somewhere in between, when you're at like 5 minutes out from either center of hash, it's only going to make sense to move closer to one of them. You can't have a center of hash like exist right in the middle. You can't be too close to some other hash center. So because in the winner takes all market, like a money, you're simply absorbed or dissolved into the larger center of hash, the dominant center of hash. So it's kind of like if you just put a giant rock between the Earth and the Moon, it would just fall one way or the other based on the pull of the two celestial bodies. That only at a certain distance and a certain acceleration can they be prevented from collapsing in on each other, just like the characteristics of DNA that separate Like there needs to, it needs to be based on the consensus window and the defensibility of the hash, and it has to be the dominant chain in each center of hash. So there's like a bunch of dynamics there that just make it so fascinating to think about these things as different creatures that have to be separated by a certain amount of space-time based on their genetic code, determined by their genetic code. So there was this old thought experiment that I always found fascinating that I think is just super applicable to this whole time chain idea and how to imagine the separation between these things. Is that if we ever figured out how to travel faster than the speed of light, that, you know, we could build something like the most advanced telescope the world has ever seen. Maybe we could make one that could see like 100 million light years across the universe. So we could like zoom in on some planet or some star and pick out like incredibly fine, like clear detail, 100 million light years away. Now, if we could travel at 100 million times the speed of light, or, well, really at that point, if we can travel faster than the speed of light, it probably means we can bend space-time, and essentially we could just teleport. But let's assume we're just traveling, we can just teleport to a location that is 100 million light years away from where we are. We could turn around and put our telescope back on Earth, and we would see the dinosaurs walking around on the planet. And it would be because we traveled to that spot in the universe before the light that bounced off the asses of dinosaurs got there. So think about that. The next time you find yourself trying to imagine how big the universe is, for somebody on the other side of the universe, like all the way on the other side, if they looked back at the spot where Earth is at this very moment, it wouldn't be there because the light from Earth's creation hasn't gotten to them yet. That's just crazy to think about. And so it's like they don't exist in the same space-time. Well, I mean they do, but they don't experience time the same way. The barrier between the time is like a dividing line between those time chains. There will be a horizon measured in the distance of light travel, the time it takes for light to reach new locations. Alpha Centauri, there would be a very interesting dynamic between Mars and Earth. But settling the new star, settling Alpha Centauri and going further than, you know, any human has gone before, blah, blah, blah. that one would not have the center of hash. The time horizon would be so great that you would never be able to. Even a hash bomb would, you'd have a 4-year gap to protect yourself or to defend against a hash bomb. And it wouldn't make any sense. Like Mars and Earth may have like a quote unquote revolution, and a Mars and Earth may have, you know, hash wars and like this tussle back and forth between the center of hash and whether or not there's two coins or one coin, etc. But Alpha Centauri, that battle would not exist. It would be totally a new pioneer. It would be a gold rush to settle distant areas in the universe because you basically get to create a new Bitcoin for your colony. Just a crazy idea. I love this article. I went way too far. I don't know how the hell I just ranted for 32 minutes about this. We're going to close this here. Don't forget to check out... How did I do that long? Okay. Don't forget to check out Dhruv. I hope I'm saying his name right. Bunsal on unchained-capital.com. This was such a fun article. I read it as soon as somebody shared it out to me like a number of weeks ago, and I immediately read it. He's like, this is such a neat idea, and I've been kind of thinking about it in the back of my head ever since. So I'm happy I really finally got to it, and I'm kind of eager to dig into it. A lot of the links that he has in there, so that's another great reason, other than just some of the awesome graphics and stuff that he has in here. There's so many other links to works from, he's got an extensive like kind of thank you that I didn't actually read at the end. What do we got here? Thanks to the colleagues at Unchained Capital for participating and tolerating the many wonderful conversations on this. Ryan Gentry, Taylor Pearson, Turda Meester, Buck Purley, Marty Bent, and Brandon Quittam for the feedback on early drafts. And then Dan Held, Clark Moody, Grisha Trebetsky, Merch, and David Harding for laying the foundation for all of those ideas. So he said a thank you to all of those people. And at that, I think he's got a number of links to other stuff to read, particularly one I'm digging into and I managed to get a little bit of skimming on was the one by Clark Moody that he links to early on in the piece. So much to check out there. Don't forget to check out unchained-capital.com. Go to their blog. I can't recommend it enough. It's just always some great reading up there. And, of course, the rest of Parker Lewis's Gradually Then Suddenly series. And don't forget to follow Dhruv on Twitter, which I will tag and link to his page in the show notes and in the Twitter post. So you can easily find all of that by following me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter. I am Guy Swan, the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And don't forget to subscribe to The Crypto Economy podcast. If you would like to support my work, if you would like to support this project in bringing all of the best Bitcoin content to audio, please consider donating. I've got a Bitcoin address, a Lightning tip jar, and of course my Patreon, which will actually get you access to the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram chat, which is a great place. We always talk about all kinds of stuff, and there's actually a really fun story. In fact, I think I'm going to have a guys take episode about this probably, because a couple of guys just worked together and caught a scammer, or at least identified and then reported to the police. And it's actually kind of an interesting little thing that we've been dealing with, and it's really cool to think that like they managed to snag the scammer. So be safe out there. Everybody remember that everybody is out to scam you. Don't trust anybody. Always verify. Do not trust. You'll end up losing Bitcoin if you don't. But yeah, if you want to join the Telegram Crypto Economy crew and hang out with the rest of us, please consider becoming a patron. But another way that you can support this show is just sharing it out. The more listeners, the more Bitcoiners we have who know about this show and can get value out of being able to listen to all of this content, to be able to consume so many articles about Bitcoin and, you know, the Unchained Capital blog and the Nakamoto Institute pieces and by all the most amazing thinkers in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space, just expose them to this and you're helping out the show. You're helping me with funding this just with, you know, the one or two promotions that I put in this show. And it makes a world of difference to keeping this thing alive. So thank you so much for listening. This is The Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, take it easy, everybody.